From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the July 2019 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, the D-Day Dodgers. In this It Happened Here episode, we leave the invasion of Western Europe and return to the hard-fought battles of the Italian campaign. Since first invading in September 1943, Italy had been anything but the soft underbelly that Churchill had called it. Finally, in the spring and summer of 1944, after months of being held back by German forces defending Italy, things started to move. With the eyes of the world on Normandy, the men fighting their way up the boot of Italy felt they had been forgotten back home, but they hadn't been forgotten by the Codebreakers at Bletchley Park. Our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, will be our guide to the vital support GCNCS gave to the armies on the Italian front. It would be their hard fighting that would ultimately lead to the capture of the first of the Axis capitals, Rome. Very special thanks to Loudon Jim for his recording of the D-Day Dodgers. We dedicate this episode to Sergeant Charles Leslie Harris and Gunner Gordon Brown, two of our own D-Day Dodgers.
We're the D-Day Dodgers. We're off in Italy, always on the Vino, always on the spree. 8th Army scroungers and their tanks, we live in Rome among the Yanks. We are the D-Day Dodgers, we're out in Italy.
This episode is called The D-Day Dodgers. Who were the D-Day Dodgers?
The term D-Day Dodger is coined in 1944 by soldiers who are serving in Italy, because they'd obviously been fighting in Italy since 1943, and they felt that all the media attention was focused on Normandy and that their story wasn't really appearing in the papers. Or if it was, it was almost considered that they were having a nice sort of sunny time in Italy and that the real fighting was going on in Normandy. Actually, the reverse was true. The Italian campaign, particularly through the winter of 43 to 44 and throughout the rest of 1944, was a very hard-fought and bitter campaign. So we're not exactly sure who wrote the song first, but a chap called Harry Pinn, his name is associated with it from November 1944. But there are a variety of versions of it that survive. So it's probably one of those songs that started out slightly organically and then somebody happened to write a version of it down. And the tune, of course, is Lili Marlene, which was the very popular German song. And that was on German radio so much when the Allied armies were in, the British army in particular, was in North Africa, that it had been kind of adopted by the 8th Army as a song for both sides in North Africa. So it was a natural tune to choose if they wanted to express their own personality down there. And so the song is basically a complaint that the campaign in Italy and the soldiers fighting there isn't getting the recognition it deserves.
Was the phrase D-Day Dodgers, was it a phrase in common parlance? Was it used in the press?
It's a little bit veiled in mystery. Some sources attribute it to Lady Astor, who was a very famous member of Parliament at the time. And she supposedly took the phrase from a letter that a soldier serving in Italy had sent her, expressing his displeasure at getting ignored. But the evidence that she did or didn't say it is difficult to pin down. She certainly mentioned in one version of the song as having coined the phrase, or she's addressed in one verse of one of the versions of the song.
The term D-Day, when we're talking about D-Day Dodgers, it doesn't just refer to Normandy, though, does it?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. D-Day is a generic phrase in military planning that refers to the day on which an operation takes place. And so prior to the 6th of June 1944, there had been many D-Days. And indeed, there had been two previous amphibious landings in Italy, at Salerno and then at Anzio. So the soldiers in Italy had kind of had their own D-Days in the sense that they stormed beaches themselves. It's only when the press adopt the term specifically in relation to Normandy that it kind of passes into the language as meaning specifically the Normandy landings. Actually, D-Day and H-Hour apply to all sorts of other operations prior to that.
And after that as well?
And after that as well.
You have heard about the daring assault of Monastery Hill at Cassino by a small number of Allied troops who found themselves pinned down there by German fire. Their communication with the rear were almost entirely cut off. First, we tried to send in runners on foot carrying packs. They didn't all come back. Then headquarters turned to the Air Force. One of the flyers of the 86 fighter bomber group who came to the rescue is here now to explain a bit how this novel operation was carried out. He is Lieutenant Ed Lucas of Greensboro, North Carolina.
Well, we fly A-36 invaders. I've been out dropping bombs and strafing on nearly 50 missions over here, but this was the first time I'd ever tried dropping packages by parachute. It's a lot different and it's pretty tricky. We went in two planes at a time. I think I was usually around 100 feet above the ground. As a matter of fact, we were below the German gun positions on top of the hill. We had to come in at relatively slow speed, or we'd never hit the proper spot.
And could you actually see those maroon men on the hillsides?
I just got a glimpse of them once. Two men were running bent over, going for a chute bundle on the ground nearby. They were keeping low to stay out of the line of German fire. We flew 183 sorties in all and delivered 324 packages of food and water, shells, grenades, and small ammunition. There were some Indian troops there who eat a lot of fish and rice, and they got that from us too.
Before we focused really clearly in these podcasts on D-Day, specifically Normandy, we were in Italy in the episode From Cassino to Kohima. What had been going on in Italy in spring, summer 1944?
Well, we left the story in Italy in the previous episode with the early battles for Monte Cassino. This, of course, is part of the Gustav Line that was built across Italy to protect Rome in particular. And after the Italian armistice in the autumn of 1943, the Germans then dug in very heavily to try and continue to defend Italy. And Monte Cassino, the monastery, had been attacked multiple times starting in January 1944.
But now for further details of the Italian campaign, Winston Burdett reported.
Practically the entire ruin that is Cassino is in our hands today. Our troops yesterday mopped up German pockets in the rubble of the blasted town, laboriously wiped out snipers and machine gun nests, and pushed on to Cassino's western rim, where the enemy was still desperately clinging to two last strong points, each one composed of the wreckage of a half dozen houses. In the hills to the west, Indian troops hammered out further sharp gains, closing the ring around Cassino to three-fourths of a circle. The Indians have edged forward toward the monastery ruins on Abbey Hill, where they now hold two humps of ground on the middle slopes. It looks as though the final assault on the abbey itself is near. This is still a battle of yard-by-yard annihilation. The Germans are still fighting with everything they have.
By the time you get to May 1944, you get the fourth Battle of Monte Cassino, as it's called. It's a kind of an ongoing campaign, but it has particular moments of intensity. The fourth battle is the successful one when the abbey finally falls to the Allies in May of 1944. Of course, the other operation we talked about at that point was the Anzio landings. And again, they begin in January, but it becomes a bit of a stalemate. The troops land, but then don't advance very far inland and end up sort of sitting in a narrow strip along the coast, more or less besieged by the Germans. So you've had, from January through to May, a fairly miserable period for the soldiers in Italy, that both the weather has been very bad, but also the fighting has been quite stalemated, and there's been a lot of very fierce fighting for relatively little gain on the Allies' side. That stalemate is broken in May with an operation called Operation Diadem, and this is the final push to try and break properly through the Gustav Line and through Monte Cassino, and simultaneously to break out of the Anzio beachhead.
Is that an international effort or...?
It is. I mean, it's a thoroughly multinational force because you have the US Fifth Army on the west coast of Italy, and initially on the east coast you have the British Eighth Army of North Africa fame. But that's not just British. It has soldiers from all of the dominions, so Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, also India, and then Polish and Free French troops. So it's a really diverse multinational force. For Operation Diadem, they're actually moved secretly westwards, more towards the Monte Cassino area, which is kind of on the west side of Italy, to reinforce the attack there. And they run quite an elaborate deception operation to persuade the Germans that they're still in their positions in the east when they're not. And the idea is that there will be a huge push at Cassino and up the Liri Valley, and that simultaneously General Truscott and his American troops in 6th Corps in the Anzio beachhead will break out of there. And the hope is that the Anzio breakout will basically cut off the troops that are fighting further south at Cassino. There have been deception operations to keep German forces confused. So they've been suggesting that there might be another amphibious landing north of Rome, which they're not going to do, but they try and persuade the Germans of that for a while. But then they change tack, and the hope is that they can lure those troops southwards to the front line around Monte Cassino, because the more troops they can pull south, the more troops they can then cut off when they burst out from Anzio.
The way you're saying, the plan, the hope, did it not end up like that?
It didn't, unfortunately. The attack around Monte Cassino was ultimately successful. The abbey fell to Polish troops at the end of May after some extremely fierce fighting. It's a moment that the Polish really commemorate as sort of one of their great military achievements.
Now, as for today's taking of the great abbey of Monte Cassino on Monastery Hill, this was an enormously hard-won triumph for Polish troops against an enemy from whom they had suffered much. In the mountain heights through which the Poles broke to get round the back of the ruined monastery fortress, fighting had been severe in the extreme. Men fought till they dropped exhausted, or dropped killed or wounded. They had to get through appalling mountain tracks, with the Germans commanding them and pouring streams of fire upon them at every move. The Poles were counterattacked time after time when they gained the height, and there was, all the time, no way up to the hill positions except by mule and finally on foot. Always the supply, ammunition and water parties had to go up through heavy German fire. In many positions, you could by day remain alive only in a hole in the ground. To show yourself and move in daylight in these forward positions was death. I was at a Polish headquarters on the morning of the capture when the news came through. We're in the abbey. Monastery Hill is occupied. It was a historic moment, and the drama was heightened when an officer put the good news right in front of my eyes. He handed me a small piece of paper. It's come from the monastery by one of our carrier pigeons, he said. And I looked at the crumpled scrap of paper. All that was on it was one large V for victory, drawn in pencil. And it was signed by a lieutenant of signals who had reached the abbey.
The abbey finally falls, and the Germans start to withdraw from there. And the breakout from Anzio is completely successful. And indeed, a number of German troops from north of Rome have been drawn down to try and support the fighting in the south. So 26th Panzer Division in particular has come down from north of Rome to join the fighting. And there is an opportunity for huge numbers of Germans to be more or less cut off by the breakout. The problem is that Rome is not very far away. And indeed, when the Anzio landing first happened, troops were able to travel from the beachhead to Rome. Very briefly, there was a few units that basically drove up there in jeeps and went, oh, we're in Rome, and then drove back again. Mm. So there's some discussion about whether Rome was capturable way back in January at the beginning of the operation. It probably wasn't. If they tried that, they probably would have come unstuck. But the plan in May certainly isn't to capture Rome. It's to cut off these German forces in the south.
Meanwhile, on the Italian front, the bare countryside of the Liri Valley, in all its early summer bloom, is the setting for a crushing drive aimed at the very heart of occupied Italy. The 8th Army has been moved secretly from the Adriatic flank to join the 5th Army. They swing into a frontal attack on German fortified positions, sweeping through them to within sight of the formidable Hitler line. Here, Canadian 8th Army units fight together for the first time in this campaign as a Canadian corps. They strike the blow which opens the second phase of the war in Italy. The Canadian Corps moves into the deep maze of concrete pillboxes, wire and tank traps, which is the Hitler line. Bearing on their shoulders the burden of a vital mission, Canadian tankmen form part of a special task force. They meet stiff opposition from crack enemy troops. Biting into the line to a depth of 5 miles in relentless close combat, a wide breach is made, allowing our full force to stream through. Named after the misguided maniac whose minions built it, this impregnable wall was going to halt the advance of the Allied armies. Sledgehammer blows from Canadian armor and infantry cracked it wide open.
The problem is that the American 5th Army, which includes the troops at Anzio, is commanded by an American general called Mark Clark. And he decides, in the middle of the operation that rather than cutting off the Germans, it would be preferable to him to capture Rome.
Was Rome strategically important then?
Not particularly. Whether or not Rome is captured doesn't alter the strategic position very much. And indeed, the Germans evacuated Rome and declared it an open city. They didn't plan to fight for it. So it wasn't a major military achievement to capture it because there were no Germans defending it. The problem was it was always going to be a major political coup for whoever captured it.
Right.
And the Americans, and certainly Clark, is more attuned to the political position than perhaps Alexander, who's commander of Fifth Army Group, who's British, is. Alexander doesn't really care about Rome. He cares about getting on the campaign. Mm-hmm. But Clark decides off his own bat and against the orders he's had from Alexander to take a left turn as he comes out of Anzio and go and capture Rome instead of cutting off all these Germans. And the result is that something like 7 divisions of German troops that would otherwise have been pinned into the Cassino position managed to retreat past Rome and live to fight another day.
Was that a decision that was supported by other generals, other commanders, other allied leaders, or was that almost unilateral decision by Clark?
I think Clark thought he could get away with it with his American commanders at the higher level, and he certainly wasn't going to get sacked for it. It wasn't popular with his immediate commanders. As I say, Alexander, who's commander of 15th Army, which has joint command of the British 8th Army and the American 5th Army, Alexander and his boss, Wilson, who's supreme Allied commander in the Mediterranean, neither of them would have been happy at all. And history has not been kind to Clark either. A lot of people consider that he made a very selfish judgment that he wanted to get his face on the front of the newspapers at the expense, potentially, of winning the campaign.
The fighting finale to knock out Germany rages throughout Italy. The big push rolls rapidly northward on the heels of American, British, Canadian, and French advance patrols. The Nazis get no chance to offer effective resistance. Now near Rome, American tanks advance along the Via Casilina as Kesselring's beaten armies are pounded into a disorganized mob fleeing northward. Lieutenant General Mark Clark, commanding the American 5th Army, proudly watches his veterans of the Anzio beachhead move up. In 3 weeks of furious fighting, more than 20,000 prisoners are taken. Crack divisions, sent into Italy with the boast that they would drive the Americans into the sea, are shattered. No more Heil Hitler for this broken Superman.
What kind of a man was Clark?
He's a controversial figure. He certainly understood the media. There are huge numbers of photographs of Clark because he took a photographer with him everywhere he went. There are huge numbers of audio recordings of him and film clips of him because he didn't let a media opportunity go by without exploiting it. He was a very successful soldier at the time. He was under 50. He was only 48 at the time of Monte Cassino. But he was already a lieutenant general, so he'd had quite a meteoric rise through the American forces, youngest three-star general in the Second World War. So he was considered, in some respects, a bit of a golden boy.
But also quite controversial.
But also quite controversial and arguably quite vain and self-interested. And so he clearly thought that capturing Rome would be good PR for the US and good PR for him, and don't worry about everybody else. Interestingly, the American historian Carlo D'Este, who has written extensively on the Second World War, it's rare for D'Este to be particularly rude about American commanders. Mm. He's quite a patriotic historian, I suppose you'd call him. He describes Clark's capture of Rome as militarily stupid as it was insubordinate.
Wow.
Which is a pretty strong term from D'Este because he doesn't normally go for people in that way. So that gives you a sense of how potentially unpopular Clark's move was.
And that's looking back on history by a historian. Did Clark's colleagues, oppos, fellow commanders feel the same way? And did they ever vocalise that?
A lot of people didn't like him. Patton didn't like him. Patton didn't like a lot of people. So it's not a very good judge necessarily. But in his private journal, wrote exactly what he thought of Clark. The sensitive amongst you, cover your ears. But what Patton said was, I think that if you treat a skunk nicely, he will not piss on you as often.
Wow.
You know, as I say, Patton didn't like a lot of people, but
straight talking there.
Yeah, straight talking there from Patton. I once went to a lecture by Robin Nellens about the Italian campaign, and he put up a series of photographs of the senior commanders. And there are lots of photographs of Clark, as I said, with people like Alexander and Wilson and other people. And it's quite easy to read the dynamics into those photographs. You look at the photographs and you look at people's expressions and how near to one another they're standing. Mm-hmm. And you can see that
their body language,
the body language says quite a lot that he wasn't necessarily a popular man with his peers, at least. He was quite unpopular with the troops as well, because back in January, at the beginning of the campaign, one of the attempts to break through the Gustav Line involved an assault crossing across the Garry River. This battle is actually better known as the Battle of the Rapido River, but one of the many errors they made was they actually got the name of the river wrong. It's more famously known as the Rapido, but it was actually the Garry River. And that proved to be unsuccessful, and a significant number of casualties were inflicted on the US troops who attempted it. So the troops tend to remember that he wasn't particularly careful with their lives. In fact, after the war, there is a congressional inquiry into the Garry River operation in particular, because a group of US veterans clubbed together and wrote to their congressman and said, we think he made a really bad decision there and he should be held to account for it. Nothing was actually done. He got off in the end. So definitely a controversial figure.
No stranger to bold decisions, let's say.
You can call them bold.
Misjudged potentially as well.
Yeah.
The United Nations onslaught is smashing ahead on many fronts. Here in Rome, in their triumphal entry into the Eternal City, United Nations troops move past great monuments of antiquity. The long history of the ancient city has seen few more joyous events. The liberators were acclaimed with ecstatic fervor.
Clark made this controversial decision to go for Rome. Was that successful in the end?
Yes, Rome was captured by US forces on 4th of June. And any other week of the year, that would have been a major media moment, propaganda moment for the Allies. It's the first Axis capital to be captured. You know, Rome this year, Berlin next year, hopefully. The complaint that the song relates to and that a lot of soldiers in Italy felt was that because it happens 2 days before D-Day, the capture of Rome is only ever, you know, a side column in the newspaper. Had it happened at any time other than 2 days before the Normandy invasion, people would remember it as a very significant moment in the war.
Do we know how Clark felt about that? If he was such a fan of
his
public image?
He certainly thought it was one of his more significant achievements. He wrote up his own diaries and he talked about the race for Rome as if, you know, different Allied powers were competing to get there first and that he won that race. Actually, nobody was competing to capture it first. He did it entirely of his own volition. But whether or not it was a good idea strategically, I think if you were fighting in Italy, the fall of Rome would be a day for celebration. And the fact that it gets completely overshadowed by operations elsewhere led to bitterness among the veterans for years afterwards. The other thing we have to remember about this is the speed with which news was broadcast in those days. You have the BBC on the wireless, you have newspapers, but things still took 24 hours. So the capture of Rome has a brief moment in the headlines on the 5th of June, but within 24 hours, it's yesterday's news. It's been completely knocked off the broadcasts and off the papers by the operations in France.
No longer on the front page.
Whereas if that hadn't happened, there might have been many more follow-up stories, much more publicity about it.
This is Godfrey Talbot speaking from Rome. I'm standing in the middle of the Piazza Venezia, and at this moment, the windows of the balcony of the Palazzo Venezia, from which Mussolini used to make his speeches, the windows have been opened, and has come out onto the balcony. Not Mussolini, who incidentally has never made any appearance on that balcony since July of last year, not Mussolini, but three Allied soldiers with their steel helmets on and their rifles in their hands. Beside them, two Romans, two people who've gone up from this square, two of the Italian people, and those four are standing there and they're waving the Italian and the Allied flags. A vastly different scene from the ones which that balcony has staged in the past.
From our Bletchley Park perspective, we're interested in the intelligence angle of these events. Can you tell me what the role of ULTRA was?
We touched in the last podcast on this topic about how, particularly in the spring of 1944, Bletchley Park was able to give really detailed intelligence to the commanders in Italy about what the Germans were up to, what their strengths were, and what their weaknesses were, because they were under quite a lot of pressure. And that continued through May and June, and indeed through to the autumn of the campaign. In 1944, the structure in Italy has been altered slightly. I've already referred to General Wilson, a very large man nicknamed Jumbo. He was both tall and broad. Wilson had taken over as Supreme Allied Commander in the Mediterranean, so he deals with all three services. Under him was General Alexander, who'd come from North Africa, of course, who's British, who led 15th Army Group. And then below him, you have Clark's 5th Army, mostly American on the one side, and Lees's 8th Army on the other side. Lees having taken over from Montgomery, who's, of course, gone back to the UK in preparation for Overlord. And indeed, Eisenhower, who was previously Supreme Allied Commander in the Mediterranean, has also gone back to Britain for Overlord. So in the spring of 44, you have a kind of new command structure in Italy. All of these high headquarters had SLUs. So Wilson, Alexander, and both Clark and Lees were receiving daily ultra from Bletchley Park.
Remind me again, SLU stands for?
An SLU is a special liaison unit. And basically, there's two parts. There's a special communications unit, there's wireless sets, and then there's the special liaison unit, who are intelligence officers. And what that means is when Bletchley Park breaks German messages, they can send precis of those messages by encrypted wireless directly to those units. And then it's the job of those units to take the information directly to the commanders. So something's been read in Hut 3 in the morning, goes to Windy Ridge, which is the radio transmission station nearby, encrypted, sent by wireless from there directly to, for example, Clark's headquarters in Italy. And so he would have that information within hours.
And these commanders aren't receiving verbatim messages as intercepted, are they? As you say, precis?
No, they're receiving versions of the intelligence. It was forbidden to send the information in the same words as the Germans used, because if that message was ever broken, it would be an immediate clue that the message has been broken. Also, Bletchley liked to try and mask where the information was actually being derived from. Most of the commanders in the field would have figured out that it was signals intelligence, but that was never formally acknowledged. It was always just referred to as special intelligence. It was just stuff that Bletchley Park magically knew. But all of these senior figures are getting this information. In the Fourth Battle of Monte Cassino in particular, in May 1944, one of the things that Ultra, the traffic from Bletchley, is able to tell these commanders is the state of the Germans as the battle is progressing. And in particular, the fact that these other units, 26 pounds and things, are moving down from the north to reinforce the line. And so Alexander is developing a really clear picture of just how many Germans are getting sucked into the battle and how badly they're doing. Because there's traffic describing, you know, their tank losses and, you know, how desperate Kesselring is to shore up the line. That comes from a variety of sources. We've talked many times in this podcast about RED, which was the German Air Force administrative enigma key. It's broken every day, but it doesn't necessarily contain very much information useful for the Italian campaign. However, the German Air Force in Italy has its own key, a key code named Leopard. And that was broken not every day, but certainly relatively regularly. We also talked about the FLIVOs, these Air Force liaison officers who were attached to German army units. And they're reporting daily to the Luftwaffe on what those German army units are doing. So the FLIVO key, Puma, was fantastic from the Allied point of view because these guys were saying everything that the German army was doing on a more or less daily basis.
That's Enigma as well, is it?
That's Enigma as well, yes. Fish is also very important. This is the Lorenz encrypted teleprinter link from Berlin to Rome to Kesselring's headquarters, codenamed Bream at Bletchley Park. And that contained huge amounts of detailed information about the state of the German troops. At the end of July, changes in Lorenz operating procedure mean that Bream is no longer readable. So through the May-June period of the Cassino battle and the fall of Rome, it's a really good source. But then the Germans changed their procedures in July and it becomes very hard to break until the autumn, till October of 1944, when they get back into it again.
Did Bletchley Park find a new way to break into the new system or did they just go back to the old way?
The problem is that the settings that are being used on the Lorenz machines, they go from a part of the setting is changed monthly and part of the setting is changed daily up until July. Then after July, both parts of the setting are changed every day, which makes the decryption process vastly more difficult.
Right.
Fortunately, at Bletchley, Jack Good and Donald Mickey figure out a way of breaking the bit that's been monthly and is now daily. They find out a way of using Colossus, and Colossus 2 in particular, to break that. And so with the advent of more Colossus machines of the second version, the Mark II, in the autumn of 1944, they were able to get back into a lot of fish traffic that they've been shut out of since July. So it's a minor procedural change that the Germans make, which makes a huge difference to Bletchley's ability to break the traffic. But then they come up with a solution and they get back in the game after a couple of months of delay.
What sort of information were these messages giving both the people at Bletchley Park and then the commanders?
Well, it's a bit like the situation we've discussed in Normandy, that Ultra is at its best talking about the bigger strategic picture and describing German forces at the divisional level when they're not actually in contact with Allied troops. Once the Allied troops are fighting a German unit, they know quite a lot about it because they're directly in contact with it. They've got their own local tactical Y service intercepting low-level communications. They're capturing prisoners. So they can work out a lot of information just from the battlefield. But where the Ultra fits in is troops that are moving to the battlefield or more general assessments of the performance of the army, but from, for example, Kesselring himself or the higher commanders. So it's a strategic thing rather than giving you tactical detail of the battle.
And these commanders, Clark, Alexander, Wilson, were they all receiving very similar intelligence or the same stuff?
They would have been receiving very similar stuff, yes. But they're not necessarily all reacting to it the same way. One of the problems with any form of intelligence is your customers, the people you give it to, have to be receptive to what you're saying. And one of the things that I've been learning as I've looked at different campaigns and different aspects of this story is the information from Bletchley Park was treated with varying degrees of favourableness or hostility by different generals. Montgomery, for example, wasn't necessarily Ultra's biggest fan for various reasons, which we've discussed previously. Clark, again, is one of these people who feels that he knows most of the answers anyway, and he doesn't necessarily need somebody second-guessing him from over his shoulder. So,
did Clark know where it was coming from? Did he have any reason not to trust it, for example? Did he know the source?
He would have been indoctrinated fairly closely into where it was coming from, yeah. He would have had a pretty good idea.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My friends, yesterday, on June 4th, 1944, Rome fell to American and Allied troops. The first of the Axis capitals is now in our hands. One up and two to go. And so I extend the congratulations and the thanks tonight of the American people to General Alexander, who has been in command of the whole Italian operation, to our General Clark, to General Lease of the 5th and the 8th Armies, to General Wilson, the Supreme Allied Commander of the Mediterranean Theater, to General Devers, his American deputy, to General Ica, to Admirals Cunningham and Hewitt, and to all their brave officers and men.
Ultra intelligence, it has this strategic angle to it. What kind of strategic picture was actually being created by the intelligence?
The real big picture that can be built up from Bletchley Park's work is the long-term projections for what's going to happen in Italy. Because the big question about Italy since the Italian armistice the previous year is how hard will the Germans actually fight for the Italian peninsula? Is there going to be a moment when they go, you know, there's no point in this anymore, let's give it up, let's retreat to the Alps and cut our losses? And that very much plays into the Allied strategic thinking. We've touched on this in the previous podcast again, but there was distinct tension between President Roosevelt and his Chief of Staff Marshall, who wanted to crack on with the invasion of Northwest Europe with the Normandy campaign and get by the shortest route possible to Berlin. And on the other hand, you have Churchill and the British perspective, which is much more focused on the Mediterranean. And Churchill really wants to fight the Italian campaign for as long as possible. And he even has aspirations to extend the campaign into the Balkans, potentially have an amphibious landing on the eastern coast of Italy, up somewhere in the Adriatic, because he can see the oil supplying the Germans from Romania as a great way of really reducing the Germans' fighting power. He's also uncomfortably aware that the further the Russians advance into Europe and into Southwest Europe in particular, the bigger problem that's going to be post-war, because you'll never get them out again. And that's, you know, that's what history proves. So Churchill was keen to have the Italian campaign prosecuted as vigorously as possible. but he's fighting against the stream for that. And he loses the argument in the summer of 1944 because the Americans come up with Operation Anvil, as it's called. The code name comes from the fact that before Overlord was known as Overlord, a preliminary plan for the invasion of northern France was known as Sledgehammer. And the idea is that Anvil will be an invasion of the south of France around Marseille and the Riviera, and it will provide the anvil to the hammer coming in the north. And this sort of pincer movement will completely destroy the Germans. The problem is Churchill's not a big fan of it. And he is not convinced that denuding Italy of troops to fight in the south of France is going to make that much difference, because you would kind of end up fighting the same Germans anyway. But there's a view that the Germans potentially are going to give up Italy anyway. And so you don't really need to push the campaign that hard there, and you can get on with fighting in France.
Is the intelligence picture that's coming out of Ultra, does it lean towards particularly supporting the US or the British position?
It does reinforce the British position. Again, like all intelligence, it depends how you read it. Mm. What Alexander draws from the intelligence is the fact that after the breakthrough of the Gustav Line, after the Cassino fighting, the German army in Italy is in pretty bad shape. His attitude is, this is the time to really push. If we absolutely batter them now when they're on the back foot, we could destroy huge numbers of German units and make huge amounts of progress. The other way of interpreting that intelligence is they're in a very poor state, so they'll probably give up soon. And we don't need to worry about them, and we can get on with fighting in France. One of the ironies of the situation is that Hitler had a conversation through traffic that was intercepted with Kesselring about this very subject. And there is a particular message, which I have here, which was intercepted on the 27th of June, which is from Hitler to Kesselring. And Hitler complains about the fact that the subsequent defensive lines in the northern part of Italy, in the Apennines, which people have been relying on as the next German line of defence, is actually only half built, and that a lot of the defences that people think exist just aren't there. And he says, if I quote from the message, "Therefore desired that misconception existing in minds of commanders and men that there was a fortified Apennine position should be scotched once and for all. Conduct of operations by Commander-in-Chief Southwest," which is Kesselring, "therefore to be directed towards gaining time until adequate development was achieved." So what Hitler is saying is, keep fighting as hard as you can where you are, and we will build up defences behind you, and then we will reinforce those, and that basically the Italian campaign is going to go on for as long as possible. And this is actually typical Hitler. It's like, you know, we're not a step back. Fight for every inch of ground. So it really reinforces Alexander's point that the campaign in Italy is worth pursuing, and it has the potential, from the point of view of the people who are excited about Normandy, that it will still tie up huge numbers of German troops. Unfortunately, that message, although transmitted on the 13th of June, was not actually broken and properly and disseminated until the 28th of June. And by the time you get to the 28th of June, the decision south of France versus Italy has already been taken in favour of the south of France.
Just being at that delay of 2 weeks.
And Operation Dragoon, as it becomes, goes ahead on 15th of August with lots of troops that have been taken from the Italian front. And the irony is that the Germans don't make a big effort to defend southern France. They know they're onto a loser there. And after a short period of campaigning, they basically evacuate the south of France. So the idea that an attack in the Riviera will draw in huge numbers of German troops that would otherwise be fighting in Normandy, it just doesn't happen. So Alexander was perhaps vindicated that carrying on fighting in Italy would have ultimately been a better approach. But what it shows is the intelligence isn't always timely, and sometimes you only find out what you needed to know kind of after the event. And this information, had it been available earlier, I mean, Alexander and Wilson might still have lost the argument about Operation Dragoon. But they would have had more ammunition to fight with had they known what the German strategy was a little bit earlier.
What might have caused this 2-week delay that had such an impact?
Well, decryption problems, basically. I believe this is actually transmitted on an Enigma network that was communicating between Kesselring's headquarters and Berlin rather than on Fish. But even the Enigma networks, some of them, they weren't broken what's called currently. They weren't broken the day they were sent. Sometimes it would take several days or weeks to break those keys. And one of the problems the soldiers in Italy have is that Bletchley is devoting a huge amount of its energies to Overlord, to the fighting in France. And on any one day, the Germans are using, by 1944, maybe 60 different Enigma keys, of which Bletchley is breaking about 20. And so they have to decide their priorities every day. They have to decide which traffic they're breaking. And in July of 1944, most of that breaking effort is concentrated on Normandy. So you might have an Italian network that was breakable, but they certainly wouldn't necessarily try and break it on the day. They would shelve it and then wait when they had a little bit of slack time later on, when they had some bomb machines spare. They go, oh, all right, we'll break that one now because we've got a moment to do it. And so you potentially get all sorts of intelligence that crops up days or weeks later simply because of the demands of other theatres.
And that's not unusual in the situation. That's a decision that has to be made
daily. It's a decision that has to be made daily by the senior managers at Bletchley. They have to go, right, which of these networks, which of these keys are we going to try and break? Which intelligence do we need most badly at this point? And a decision may well have been taken that the particular network that this traffic was sent on wasn't a priority on 13th of June. And so those people were tasked to look at something in Normandy instead. And it's only, as I say, sometime later that they go, we've got a moment spare. Mm-hmm. Let's break that as well. And it's a dilemma that Bletchley faces all the time. The Italian campaign is very well supported by Ultra, but they get the most benefit from it in the first half of the year when they're the only theatre in operation on the Western Allied side. As soon as Normandy starts, then Bletchley's energies have to be divided between the various theatres.
We landed in Salerno, a holiday we pay. The Jerrys brought their bands out to greet us on our way. Showed us the sights and gave us tea. We all sang songs, the beer was free. To welcome D-Day Dodgers to sunny Italy. Naples and Cassino were taken in our stride. We didn't go to fight there, we went just for the ride. Anzio and Sandro were just names. We only went to look for Danes. The artful D-Day Dodgers way out in Italy.
You said about the sledgehammer and the anvil. Where else was fighting taking place in Europe?
Well, the big operation that here in the West we tend to forget about because everyone thinks about Normandy is the Soviet offensive of the summer of 1944. Stalin had promised that in exchange for his second front, an attack by the Western Allies in France, that would be supported by an effort on the Eastern Front by the Soviets. And in fact, the effort that the Soviet army launches in June 1944 is absolutely epic. They launch a series of attacks which are under the coverall codename of Operation, I know it is Bagration, but your Russian is better than mine.
Bagration.
Bagration, who's a Napoleonic general. The operation was named after him. But it's an absolutely enormous assault on not quite all of, but a huge portion of the northern part of the Eastern Front. And the simple numbers involved are staggering. The Russians committed something like 1.6 million troops to the operation. They had 4,000 tanks almost. They had another 2,000 assault guns. There's 30,000 pieces of artillery supporting the operation.
Those numbers are enormous.
They are enormous. It's a huge, huge battle. And military historians remember it not only for its size, but it's also because the Soviets developed, through the Second World War, operational doctrines, ways of fighting these kind of massive battles, which were really new. The ideas had actually been developed in the 1930s by some quite forward-thinking generals, but a number of them were killed in Stalin's purges before the Second World War. And then for the first couple of years of the campaign, the Soviets, because they were having to move all their tank factories to the east and they'd lost huge numbers of men, the Soviet army spent several years rebuilding itself. By the time you get to 1944, you have an army that is big enough and is well enough led and well enough organized to really bring these doctrines that the Soviets have developed into use. And they use the term deep battle. I won't attempt the Russian of it. And this is the idea that you don't just defeat the soldiers in front of you. You plan to penetrate as far as possible into your enemy's rear areas and you destroy their headquarters and you kind of ignore a lot of the troops that you encounter in the first stages of the battle. And also that all of your attacking formations, they talk about echelons, the idea that you will have a unit you know, often a very large unit, an army-level unit, that smashes a hole in the German line. But behind that is another unit of similar size that can then push through and totally disrupt what's going on behind.
That sounds like the Roman army, where one line falls and there's another ready there behind it.
It is. It's kind of an offensive version of that. It became very, very heavily studied by Western historians and military thinkers, because the fear was in the Cold War that this is what the Russians were going to do when they came over the inner German border. This is how they would get to the Rhine in 7 days, was by reiterating deep battle. And deep battle is what they do in Operation Bagration. And it's extraordinarily successful. It absolutely smashes the German forces that's up against. The Germans have their forces on the Eastern Front broadly divided. You have Army Group North, Army Group Centre, Army Group South, and a couple of other smaller ones. Army Group Centre is basically destroyed by this attack. Out of 34 divisions they have in the front, 28 of them more or less cease to exist.
Had anything like that been achieved before?
No, this is an unprecedented success in the Second World War. And again, attention in the West tends to focus on Normandy, but during July and August, this is what's happening in the East. And the Germans, both in Normandy and Italy, must have had more than one eye over their shoulder to see what was going on in Russia, because it was absolutely catastrophic for them. They take nearly 500,000 casualties. The casualty figures are debated, because it was such a disaster they never really counted everybody. But the numerical loss for the German army is bigger than in Stalingrad the year before.
Gosh.
So it's a real game changer on the Eastern Front. The initial objective is the Belarusian city of Minsk, but actually the operation takes the Soviet army more or less to Warsaw. By beginning of August, they are on the river, on the Vistula, looking at Warsaw. At that point, one of the more unsavoury aspects of the Second World War occurs, because in the light of the advancing Soviet forces, the Polish resistance decided that this would be a good moment to stage an uprising in Warsaw and try and kick the Germans out of Warsaw, sort of in preparation for the arrival of the Soviets. And also, there was a lot of political concern among the Polish government in exile that they needed to do something that made sure that Poland wasn't just absorbed by the Soviets, and they made their mark against the Germans as Poles. So you have the Warsaw Uprising in August and September of 1944. Cynically, the Russians stop on the other side of the river, wait for the Germans to crush the Warsaw Uprising, and then capture Warsaw. Because Stalin had no interest in Polish nationalism, any kind of success for independent Poland. He was much happier to see the uprising completely crushed by the Germans and wait for it to finish, and then roll over the ruins. And they are literally ruins. Warsaw, by the end of the uprising, was more or less razed to the ground. The Western allies are very concerned about this, but there's very little they can do about it. They do try and fly in supply drops to the Poles fighting, but the airspace is controlled by the Russians, and the Russians are very reluctant to let the RAF in. The Polish parachute brigade that is formed in the UK and would become famous during the Arnhem operations in September 1944, they hadn't been used during D-Day, so they were still waiting to drop. Their commander was anxious that the Polish parachute brigade should potentially be dropped into Warsaw to assist with the uprising. Logistically, that wasn't really possible. Flying an entire brigade of paratroops halfway across Europe wasn't really an option. But actually, it probably wouldn't have helped, given the Soviet attitude to the whole thing. But it's one of the sadder episodes of the Second World War. It comes at the end of a hugely successful Soviet operation.
World News Today. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
On the Eastern Front, Berlin acknowledges the German troops are withdrawing at certain points from the Carpathians to the Baltic, and there are indications the Russians are about to step up the speed of their offensive once again. The Eastern Front is showing signs of breaking into movement today, which may quickly sweep the Russians into Warsaw and East Prussia. A German military commentator has admitted that Russian attacks against the Hungarians were only partly repelled, as the Soviets renewed their pressure towards Slovakia and Hungary. And east and north of Warsaw, a Russian tank attack forced a German retreat of several miles. The Germans also admitted fresh Russian gains northwest of Bialystok.
Do we know the state of German intelligence at that point? Because obviously this is a huge defeat of the Germans. The scale of this is vast. Could any of this be attributed to the lack of intelligence that the Germans were able to get about what they were facing?
The Germans had quite good intelligence on the Eastern Front. They had a fairly thorough understanding of the Soviet army. But it's not so much about the German intelligence failure as Soviet success in deception. We talk a lot in the West about bodyguard and fortitude and the deception operations around D-Day, and, you know, Hitler believed that the invasion might be in Calais. This Soviet doctrine I've been talking about, a big part of deep battle and Soviet doctrine in the Second World War, is what they call maskirovka, which is deception. And basically, the Russians never dug one trench. They would dig a trench that they were going to use, and they would dig a fake trench somewhere else. Their level of deception was integrated to that level in their planning.
So from what I understand, maskirovka means disguise, but it's not just camouflage. It's actually deception, disinformation.
It's on all levels. It's radio disinformation. It's building dummy positions. It's moving troops to an area during the day and then moving them back at night. Soviet commanders were encouraged, ordered to dream up as many different disguises, deceptions as possible.
And they employed these tactics as standard.
And it was a standard part of their tactical approach. NATO has adopted this now. If you look at an operational brief for the British Army now, one of the headings that they have to fill in when they write an operational brief is deception. Operational orders, they always include a paragraph where you go, what are we going to do to fool the enemy into thinking we're doing something else? So a certain number of troops will always be set aside to attack in a different place or to maneuver somewhere to create a false impression. That's copied from the Soviets, and the Soviets were masters of this in the Second World War. And so they launch all sorts of deception operations to persuade the Germans that the attack is going to fall elsewhere, and German intelligence just can't keep up with that, really. One of the ironies of Bagration is that the Russians lose more troops than the Germans. Their casualties are, again, estimated, because nobody really knows, but they're potentially up at around as high as 700,000 or 800,000. So it's hugely costly for the Soviets. The whole war is hugely costly for Russia. The casualties in the East dwarf anything that happens in the West.
But these are enormous armies with incredible skill. You've just been saying they have these amazing tactics that they're using, and yet these huge numbers of casualties.
Yeah, we talk about this with intelligence, but it, you know, doesn't matter how much maskirovka you have, somebody still has to fight. And the fighting on the Eastern Front is always very, very bitter and hard fought.
What did the Western allies know about the battle? How did they follow it, as it were?
Well, there is supposedly intelligence sharing between the Western allies and Stalin. And obviously, conversations have been had in advance about the idea that the Russians will launch a supporting operation. They share a certain amount, but certainly in advance of the operation, they're reluctant to share very much because, again, their whole maskirovka thing, Stalin is terrified that if he tells something to the British, that somehow we will leak it to the Germans. So they need to retain their own operational secrecy. But even once the operation begins, they're rather reluctant to explain what's going on. However, Bletchley Park in particular can follow the battle in quite a lot of detail because in addition to intercepting networks in Italy and in Normandy, they, since 1941, have been listening to the battle on the Eastern Front. And one of the features of shortwave radio is that it travels for enormous distances. And it is possible for interception stations in the UK to hear radio messages from Russia. So German Enigma networks in Russia can be heard by UKY stations.
So there were military and civilian people in Britain listening in to what was happening.
Yeah, they were listening to encrypted German Morse that came from Enigma networks on the Eastern Front, as well as ones in France or in Italy. And interestingly, I was talking to some of the veterans in the Coastal Y service who actually listened to German voice radio. And typically they were listening to ships in the English Channel. But on more than one occasion, one of the veterans said that they suddenly started hearing weird voices that didn't make any sense coming from a ship. And what they were actually hearing was voice communication between individual German tanks on the Eastern Front, that by some weird freak of the atmospheric conditions and the radio conditions, these signals had travelled all the way around.
Goodness.
And were heard. It was only a sort of brief sort of few minutes, but they were going, you know, this isn't an E-boat in the channel. What are these people talking about? And then they dialed around a bit and they started hearing Russian and they went, we're hearing tactical communications from the Eastern Front.
I was sent up to Withernsea, which, apart from one station in Scotland, was the most northerly of our coastal stations. It was in a requisitioned hotel called St. Leonard's, right on the seafront. And the main point of our being there was the interception of German radio. Our watchroom looked out over the North Sea, and further down the coast, they had a more exciting time in a way, because they used to get the German E-boats coming over to attack convoys going down the coast. And they were getting, of course, plain language German, because they had no time to code or anything. At Withensea, we were using high frequency as well as VHF. So we were picking up more long-distance traffic from the Baltic and the North Sea. I remember one of our very regular clients was Elbe-Weser Radio, which was a control on the North Sea somewhere. They had very loud signal and no problem picking them up. We also used to occasionally get some rather odd messages, plain language, which didn't fit in with the German naval codes, which the signalman always used pretty carefully. These were different, and we found eventually we were listening to German tanks on the Eastern Front and picking them up on a what we call a skip distance on HF, which for some reason we could hear just occasionally in Yorkshire. So it wasn't a tremendously active operational station like some of the ones further south. It was a very good first station to work in. And many of my friends for life were people I worked with there.
What sort of things were they being able to pick up then in that case?
That was a freakish moment, and it only lasted for a few minutes, so they didn't really make much sense of what they heard. On the normal Enigma encrypted Morse, that was fairly readily audible and was intercepted. And it's also intercepted down in Palestine in the Middle East, and mostly for naval purposes. There's actually a Y station up in Murmansk as well. So this is German Army and Air Force communication. The problem with the summer of 1944 is the German wireless networks at divisional level, so the kind of stuff that's being encrypted by Enigma, those formations are so disrupted by the battle that their communications fall apart as well as everything else. So the ability to follow the battle through Enigma diminishes as the summer goes on. However, fish networks, because they're that much level higher up, are still intact and are still discussing the battle on the German side quite intensely. And there are several fish links which are broken in 1944 that give insights into this. Gernard is one. Whiting is another one. And Whiting is particularly interesting for us because we have original decrypts of Whiting.
Whiting
down in Block
is a name I recognise from our exhibitions.
Yes, Whiting was for the army group up in Courland, which is in the Baltics. The messages we have are actually from 1945, but they started listening to that link in 1944 during the Soviet offensive. So they're getting a pretty good picture of what the Russians are doing from the German reports of it.
How would you sum up the summer of 1944 outside of France?
Well, a lot of the focus in the press and everything else was on France, and historically people remember 1944 as the year of D-Day. Actually, as we've discussed, major things were happening in the Italian campaign, and probably the biggest battle of all in 1944 is happening on the Eastern Front. And that's the case for much of the war. We tend to take a Western perspective and think about the campaigns that the British and the Americans were involved in. But the Eastern Front is huge. And I think anybody in the know in Germany must have realised that between Overlord in the West and Bagration in the East, you know, the number was up for Germany sooner or later. For Bletchley, they've gone from managing intelligence for one theatre in Italy to now managing intelligence for a number of theatres. On the land side, they're also doing the naval battle and the Far East. But it's an enormous jump in workload. And so Bletchley would have been busier than ever.
Do we have any evidence for what Bletchley Park being stretched looks like?
In a way, we don't, because the traffic that they didn't intercept, we don't see. You know, the messages they didn't break, we don't read. Mm-hmm. But particularly the case with Alexander in Italy shows that they're not able to be as across everything as they perhaps would have liked to have been. And the battle isn't over. We'll find out as this year progresses, there were a number of occasions when intelligence was really stretched in the remainder of 1944 and into 1945. There was quite a lot of confidence around the summer of 44 after D-Day. You could use the First World War phrase, which wasn't true in the First World War either, that people felt that perhaps the war would be over by Christmas. There was an element of, if anything, overconfidence at that period. But as time will show, it wasn't over yet by any means.
Dear Lady Astor, you think you're mighty hot, standing on the platform talking Tommy Rot. your England's sweetheart and her pride. But we think your mouth's too bleeding wide. We are the D-Day Dodgers in sunny Italy. Look around the mountains in the mud and rain. You'll find the scattered crosses, the some that have no name. Heartbreak and toil and suffering gone. The boys beneath them slumber on. They are the D-Day Dodgers who will stay in Italy. They are the D-Day Dodgers who will stay in Italy.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.